Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
Hey, you're listening to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. And my name is Marvin Yeo.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today with another great author interview. We're interviewing Amanda Jayatissa, the author of My Sweet Girl, a new mystery suspense thriller that's out on September 14th.
Yeah, the book is dual narrative, and it's set in Sri Lanka and also the Bay Area. And the book is about Paloma, who was adopted from a Sri Lankan orphanage. And as a 30-year-old now living in the Bay Area, she finds out that her roommate was murdered. And there's a lot of doubts playing in her mindset and a lot of ghost spookiness involved. We don't want to spoil anything for this book because it's a thriller and there's a lot of great red herrings and all.
Yeah. Like Rira said, it is a dual narrative. It takes place in two different time frames, and the book is all about your past catching up with you. So Rira and I both read it, and it keeps you guessing right until the very last sentence.
Yeah, yeah. Like, if you're a fan of noir fiction and also just, like, psychological thrillers, I think you'll really enjoy the book. And we really enjoyed talking to Amanda about her writing journey and her penchant for spooky ghost stories.
Yeah,
it was a lot of fun talking to her, so we hope you enjoy our interview.
Yeah, so without further ado, here is our conversation with Amanda Jayatissa. And we're here with author Amanda Jayatissa, the author of My Sweet Girl, her debut novel, which is a mystery thriller set in Sri Lanka and California. Welcome to the show. We're so happy that you're here with us.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me, both of you. I'm very, very excited because this is my very first podcast.
Oh, Now we're nervous to make sure that this is a good experience for you.
Oh, I'm sure you both will be fine. It's me that we have to be worried about.
And are you calling in from Sri Lanka?
Yes. Wow. It is currently 11:30.
Okay.
At night. Yeah. So not too late.
Yeah, it's 11 in the morning for us. So I guess it's like we're perfectly halfway around the road from each other.
Exactly. Perfectly halfway across.
Well, congratulations on your debut novel.
Thank you.
It's Rira and I both read it, and it's very riveting from start to finish, so many twists. But before we get to that, we always like to start off the show with new authors asking, you know, how you became an author, because Rira and I have read Asian American authors for the last like 5 years, but still feels fresh when we find that they're our new debut authors that are Asian. And, you know, we're always fascinated by, you know, the journey that you take to become a published author. So what was your journey to become author like?
Well, it didn't start off as a conscious choice or anything. I was just a very heavy reader. You know, I was one of those kids who just preferred reading to doing anything else. You know, very bookish. Once I was found at It was my own birthday party, and I was locked in a bathroom reading.
Respect.
Yeah, my poor parents, right? So just because I always love reading so much, I think writing is just something I did. It's just something I started doing. I don't think I paid that much attention to it. I've always kept journals. I've always written these terrible little poems, I think, when you're young and a little angsty. And I think when I was about 9 or 10, I sort of just decided, okay, I'm going to write my first book. It was a mystery, very much in like that Enid Blyton vein, like a Famous Five-esque, you know. It was, the characters were like named after me and my cousins, and we were going to the seaside, and there was like, it was just a very typical story, total ripoff. And I remember telling my mom, I was like, oh, you know, I'm writing this book. And she said, great. You know, she was so encouraging. She was like, great. You write that book. We'll get it published. So 9-year-old me, you know, with my pink gel pen, thought this was fantastic. And I had, you know, all the confidence in the world. And I really think I have my mother to thank for that, because I never felt, you know, that I was restricted in any way, or that there was a ceiling or anything like that. Of course, you know, life happened. I wrote on and off, hit roadblocks like everyone did. And I remember it was I was working on this novel that was, it was taking a long time because I was doing a lot of things at, you know, the same time. We had businesses we were running. I was doing my master's. And my 30th birthday was coming up. And, you know, you set these funny little goals for yourself, right? You think, oh, if I don't do it by the time I'm 30, it'll never happen. So, like, by my 30th birthday, by hook or crook, I'm going to write this book and I'm going to, you know, put it out into the world and I'm going to see what happens, because, you know, I have to see. I have to know if this thing that's consuming me, if this thing that I love doing so much, if what people's response to it would be, really. So I rushed that process. It was pretty ill-advised, I would think. I you know, I wrote this book. I was like, great. You know, I'm just going to self-publish. And I did. And I mean, I self-published in Sri Lanka, where it was relatively well received. It won a local award, which was fantastic, helped me really sort of bolster my confidence. And and then I thought, okay, I need to get serious about this, because I loved doing it. It just made sense for me to get out there.
I love that you won an award when you weren't even serious about it.
I mean, I still think it's serious. I mean, it's so great that your mother was encouraging about your writing and that you had so much confidence, because I feel like writing is, I've met so many insecure writers and there's just so much self-doubt. And I think it's because you're alone when you're writing and you're, you know, second guessing yourself. So it's really, like, it's really amazing that your mother was so like, yeah, let's go publish that book of yours when you're 9 years old. That's not something we hear that often.
Oh, no, she was great. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm very, very insecure about my writing. Like, imposter syndrome is so real, you know, and I spend so much of my time just like fixating, like, do they hate it? Does everyone hate it? Like, why am I here? What is this? But it definitely did help, I think, from a young age, getting that reassurance and not getting laughed at or anything, you know, when you're 9 and your ideas are ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people love to read, but the people who read and decide, I can do this too, and actually do it, it's still few and far between. And it's admirable that you were able to translate that love into that love of consuming to the love of creating. And I totally related to you getting stuck reading a book. I've been late to many a thing because I was like, just one more chapter. I can just finish this and leave. I have no time. LA traffic is nothing.
That's true.
Famous last words.
Yeah. So I heard that you participated in DV Pit. Was that for this book or for a different manuscript?
No, it was for this one.
Awesome. Oh my God. Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. It changed my life, really. I was finding the querying process, I think as many aspiring writers do it, I was finding it very daunting, I guess, is the word. I spent a lot of time on my, just like my submission materials, on my querying materials, because I couldn't get it right. And I rewrote that first chapter at least like 5 or 6 times, you know, going back and forth. And it happened in such a serendipitous way, actually. I was waiting for a meeting to start. The person I was meeting with was running late. And so I thought, hey, I'll just go on Twitter really quickly just to check what's going on. I don't even check my Twitter that often, but I did. And then I saw all these hashtags like, oh, DV Pit. I was like, oh, I wonder what that is. And it's like, diversity. Oh, okay. I was like, I guess that, like, I definitely qualify. I know I do. So I was like, oh, this book sounds like it would be something that I could maybe tweet about here in this space. And, you know, I couldn't wait for that meeting to finish. I felt really bad. I was like, gotta get out of here. Gotta compose that tweet. And I remember just rushing back home and like spending the next hour writing up these little tweet pitch things. And just being so overjoyed, you know, just getting likes on them. I was like, oh my goodness, like another heart. Yes. It was just such a wonderful experience. And I met my absolutely fantastic agent that way. And I think I've been very lucky during this process, because I think my agent and my editor and my creator team in general have been so open and attentive, I guess, to my story and making sure that they don't censor me and censor my message, which was a worry that I had. You know, when you get into something like this and you're really writing things, they can be a little bit, I mean, they're your experiences, but, you know, each individual experience can be controversial in certain senses. So I was very, very lucky that everyone was very respectful and very open to those experiences. So, yeah,
it's like we've had authors on the show who also found representation through DV Pit and similar like online events. And it's just so great because, like, I know for a lot of these writers, like, you know, they don't know where to go after they finish their book. And publishing has been, you know, mostly white, mostly male. And it's just so nice that there is a platform and there is, like, this mentorship where you can get representation. And I'm sure because you self-published first, it was a totally different experience to have other people on your team and actually, like, you know, help you rewrite your book. Because when you're self-publishing, everything is, you know, on you.
That actually makes such a huge difference. I didn't realize how important and how much I actually now appreciate and value this collaborative process that goes into, you know, publishing a book. You know, with self-publishing, you're just like, oh, yeah, I think that's a great idea. I'm just going to do it. And you just realize, like, all the cogs and wheels of publishing. Like, when I first got my publishing deal, I was like, and, you know, we're publishing a year away? Like, that's such a long time. Like, what goes on in a year? And I'm like, now, it's like, wow, okay. I totally know what goes on in a year. Like, a year is not enough. Oh, my goodness. Like, my publication date's coming up. You know, it's less than a month away now. And I'm like, oh, my goodness, that's so soon. How am I going to, you know, deal with this? The process has been unreal. But I'm so glad, so, so glad to have an amazing team. I really don't know how I would have gotten through this process without them. I'm very grateful.
Yeah, I mean, your book is coming out September 14th, but you've been getting a lot of buzz for your books. I've been seeing your book, like, listed on, like, Goodreads, upcoming anticipated reads of 2021 and, like, a bunch of other, magazines who have listed your book. And, you know, like, I can see why there is so much good press for your book, because when I was reading your book, I was at the edge of my seat. It was just so, I think because I am a very big consumer of thrillers, not just in books, but also TV. I am very good at predicting things. And even when I do predict things, I don't mind as long as the red herrings are there, the clues are there. And for a lot of thrillers, when the ending is predictable, it kind of falls through. But with your book, I was just like, oh, I should read this again, because there are some things that I missed the first time around. And it just seems like there was a lot of meticulous planning with the twists and whatnot. We're not going to spoil anything for our listeners mm-hmm. out there. but can you talk a little bit about how you, outlined your book, planned the mystery behind it? There's a lot of, techniques that are in your book, dual narrative.
Mm-hmm. So what was interesting about this book, at least the way I think I approach writing in general, so not just for this book, but I usually like to figure out what I want the big reveal or the plot twist to be before I start writing, before I come up with anything else. I like to have that lockdown, because I think very much, like you said, Rira, for me as well, it's that aha moment at the end, right? It's that, oh, I never saw that coming, or yes, I had that figured out, but oh my goodness, I didn't expect it to be like this, or what did I miss? And spending the next couple of days thinking through that's what I missed. Okay, that's what, the breadcrumbs, I call them. I was like, oh, I missed those breadcrumbs. So for me, it was, I knew what that was going to be, but I was working on a completely different book, and it was a very different story, and I was kind of trudging along for a few months, and it just wasn't gelling together. It something wasn't working. And after I had a really bad day, a very unfortunate incident at my bank, actually, where I got really annoyed. And, you have those moments where you get really angry, but you can't say it. You have to kind of bottle it all in and smile through the whole thing. So I was doing a lot of that. And then I kind of went away to my favorite cafe, and I took out a notebook and a piece of paper, and I really started writing these really mean, angry thoughts about this poor customer service rep at the bank. And after a while, I started realizing how much fun I was having. And that's when this character, that's when Paloma really sort of came about. And I was enjoying her way of speaking and this narrative style that's not really me, because I don't really speak like that or think things like that. But, after a while, I was like, hey, I'm having so much fun writing like this. Could perhaps that other little device that I was using work with this different narrator in a different setting? And I moved things around, and it was like this jigsaw puzzle, sort of like the pieces were all falling together, and suddenly it made sense. So the first draft actually got written very, very quickly, probably in a few months. And then I spent a lot of time editing, obviously going back and forth. And then after I met my agent, she's very, very meticulous in her plotting, and she helped me strengthen it so much more. She kind of really elevated it from then on. So I definitely think for anyone who's aspiring to write in this genre, having that, person or people or their support group really kind of look over what you're doing to make sure the plot beats work makes a lot of sense. So yeah, again, collaborative process. It's been a lifesaver.
I mean, I feel like your book is working on so many different levels, right? You're working on different timelines, different perspectives, unreliable narrators. There's so many moving pieces. It always feels like to me, especially when I talk to authors of mystery and thrillers, it feels like such a challenge to write one of these. What drew you to this genre?
I've just always loved this idea that there's something to be solved. I think that's kind of my approach to life in general. It's like, oh, there's a problem, we must solve it. I'm just one of those people. So with this, I've always just loved the idea that this almost like this sleight of hand, this what have you been missing, what is the plot twist, and that feeling you get. It's like book hangover is what I call it. You know, when you finish a book and you can't stop thinking about it. So I read obviously a lot of mysteries and thrillers and suspense, and I loved it. And I also love like the creepier books. I generally like a lot of horror, I watch a lot of horror movies, that kind of thing as well. So it was very natural for me that I gravitated towards this kind of genre and this space. And I'm just having such a good time writing in it. So it's been so much fun.
Yeah, I definitely got like goosebumps and like the creeps. I was reading this book on my phone, and every so often I would just kind of glance over like the edge of my screen. I'm like, is there someone like watching me? Asian ghosts are so scary. Our folklore is just like if you watch Asian horror movies, like the ghosts are like 100 times scarier than like Hollywood comes up with. Yeah, so
sorry, I
just
couldn't agree more.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you, like, you base like the ghosts and creepy stuff from like Sri Lankan folklore? Because we're not really familiar with it, so we can't confirm it on our own.
Sure. Mohini is it is my favorite ghost story, and who would have a favorite ghost story? One might ask. Me. Mohini is very much probably one of our most famous urban legends here in Sri Lanka. It's very stereotypical, you know, woman in white that I think you see across many, many cultures. But sort of the story is very, but at its core, it's a woman dressed in white. She's always carrying a baby. She always kind of asks for help from preferably lonely male travelers, you know, in the middle of the night. Like I said, the stories branch out. Sometimes she asks them to hold the baby, and when sort of they look into this bundle that she hands over to them, you know, that's the last thing they ever see. Sometimes she gets into the car with them, and then after a while she just disappears. But then the men are driven to sort of madness and end up killing themselves after a few days. There are so many different variations of this story, but it's a story that was very special to me because it's a story we grew up sort of whispering to each other around a candle in the night. I have actually dressed up as Mohini and to scare my cousins when I was very young. I had this like long black hair, and I messed it up across my face, borrowed a white dress from my mom, and like they were terrified. It was hilarious. So when I knew that I needed to include this sort of ghost story element, or I really wanted to include this ghost story element into the book. And then I had kind of made up something else, and it wasn't working. And I knew it's like, this is the story, like this story has to make it into the book, because it was a story that really defined a lot of the scary stories of my childhood. And I loved being able to include it in My Sweet Girl. So.
Yeah, I definitely got some like gothic horror elements to it as well, and that's a genre that I absolutely loved when I was a kid. So, but like a lot of the gothic horror I consumed were British, so it was like nice that it was like set in Asia and we had Asian characters, and like I just love the fact that like the voice of Paloma came from your angry like that bad experience with customer service, just writing like an angry Yelp review. Like I just love how I just love how all of that rage and meanness came in your book, but at the same time your book's title is called My Sweet Girl. And it just reminded me how for a lot of women, especially Asian women, we're expected to have this I guess, like, mask to be polite. And we're trained at a very young age to be as accommodating as possible. So I just want to ask, like, was that a theme that you planned on having when you were writing your book? This, like, duality of having, I guess, like, a polite self and just, like, holding back a lot of rage in your character.
In a very inadvertent way, which is interesting, because the thing about Paloma, and I didn't do this consciously, but she swears a lot, right? She uses a lot of very colorful language through the book.
Which I appreciate.
I'm glad you do. But the thing about her is she never says it out loud. All of that is in her head. And I wrote it that way without really realizing that I was writing it that way. And it was only one of my very first readers who pointed it out. She was like, Amanda, did you mean to do that? I was just like, that's really interesting. Did you mean to do that? I was like, actually, no, it wasn't something I was doing consciously. I was just thinking about, as a brown woman in a white space, how would you typically react? How were you conditioned to react? How did I react when there were things that angered me when I was living in the Bay Area? And I certainly wouldn't, you know, throw out a couple of bad words out there. There wasn't my, you know, my go-to. I would think it perhaps sometimes, but it wasn't a natural sort of reaction. So her character really came from thinking about a very, not necessarily the meanness, but her way of navigating society. A lot of that, I think, came from my own way of having to go about it when I lived in the U.S.
Yeah, like, I definitely got that. As someone who is very non-social, and, like, when I was little as well, like, I was considered, like, the very nice girl and the very quiet girl. But at the same time, like, even when I was young, I'm just like, I just want to kill everyone. And I really, like, I really hate the fact that I have to be quote unquote nice in order to get by. And I think it's an experience that a lot of Asian women and just, like, women in general, like, go through. And I thought it was really funny how throughout the book, Paloma gets mistaken as a different brown woman. And it's just like, yeah, like, that is something that is so relatable. Just like, it's the same for any person of color. We're just so interchangeable and invisible. Mm-hmm. And I just love the fact that you put that into your book. So, like, was that based on, I just want to ask, like, it's it's based on your own experience. What is the worst experience that you've had with being mistaken as the other Asian woman?
The lady at the post office in my university handed me someone else's package. I was like, no, that's not me. She's like, oh, no, it's you. Like, no, it isn't really. It's not my name. She's like, yeah, but you were just in here yesterday. Like, what are you getting at? I was like, it was really funny because she refused to believe that it was, you know, like, the one of the very few other brown women on campus. And we were friends. So we used to sometimes, I was like, do you not realize that there are two of us? Like, we're standing right next to each other. Like, what do you think? But we used to get mistaken for each other all the time. I had, you know, people come up to me and say things like, you know, I love that pink skirt you were wearing yesterday. Where did you get it from? It's like, I don't own, like, I mean, I don't own a skirt. At that point, I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. And then after a while, it clicked to me. I was like, oh, okay, you're talking about this other woman. There's a scene in the book where she's at a bathroom at a bar, and this other woman comes up and starts speaking to her like she's known her and met her before at a party. Like, that's something that pretty much happened to me almost exactly like that. So there's a lot of being mistaken.
Yeah, I just, like, it's fine to be mistaken. I mean, it's not fine to be mistaken as someone else, but it's just so interesting when they just buckle down and they're like, no, I am right. Like, I know that you're this person. And it's like, I think I know my own name. I think I know, like, my own friends. Since you shared your worst experience with being mistaken as the other brown girl, the worst experience for me was when I was at the mall and I was like 18 years old and this old white lady kept calling me like, it's like, oh, Connie, like Connie. And I'm just like, who's Connie? Why is this lady following me? And she got really angry because I was ignoring her. So she came up to me and grabbed my arm and was just like, why are you ignoring me? Like, I haven't seen you in so long. And I was just like, let go of me, lady. Like, I am not like this person. And she tried to like convince me that like I was her kid's nanny. And I'm like, I'm 18 years old. Like, I am like, you're getting the age wrong. You're getting the wrong person. Wow. It was very interesting. And I love the fact that you explore, I guess, like the like white privilege in your book, because Paloma is adopted. And I do want to talk about that because a lot of adoptees have talked about like their white parents having kind of this savior complex. And I just want to ask, like, did you talk to other adoptees about their experiences with dealing with parents who don't know their privilege and might have good intentions, but things aren't adding up in their brain?
To a few, yes. Probably not appropriate for me to name names, but there were definitely a few women that I spoke to from Sri Lanka who had been adopted, but also from other cultures. And there was definitely a trend in what they were saying. And it's not really fair to kind of, I think, categorize everything in this whole like, oh, there were white saviors, because the relationships are very complex, right? A lot of them absolutely adore their adoptive parents, have very, very good lives. And I have to say, like, even with the orphanage, like, I know that I wrote this very gothic sort of orphanage, but I've spent a lot of time volunteering and like helping out and working at orphanages. And, you know, the atmosphere is certainly not always like that. But there are certain... just like at their crux, there are certain things that you see these glimmers of. And that's what I caught on to. But of course, in the sense that it worked in my story and how this story needed to be told. So it's not everyone's story, certainly, but there are little bits and pieces that I've seen scattered along the way.
I wonder if a lot of your like non-Asian readers will like get a lot of those glimmers, because I feel like there's a lot of inside jokes in your book, and like like the whole the people who talk about how exotic your culture is, and it's like, well, it's not exotic to me. This is my identity. This is like this is just my life. And just to kind of like commodify it as something to be sold to just kind of have, I guess, like a inspirational story to your life. It's something that we see a lot in other people's like experiences. Of course, it's not everyone's experience, but like you said, there are like glimmers of it. And I wonder if a lot of readers out there will catch it.
Again, like I can't speak to their experience, right? It is sort of a lot of my own personal things and things that I've picked up on. But I think as hopefully what, you know, as more authors from different backgrounds come forward with their novels and they get published and people read them, that there will be at least some sense of understanding of, you know, that's like some bridges might be crossed and some understanding might be gained. We don't sort of know. And it's interesting because when you were talking about this idea of being exoticized, it's always only certain elements that are exoticized, right? Usually things like how you look, but your certain like mannerisms or certain habits, those things are not exoticized at all. Those things are frowned upon, right? God forbid you like eat with your hands and you see, you know, these like looks of horror, you know, people are like, oh no, that kind of behavior doesn't fly here. You're like, no, but that's how you eat. Like for me, that would be how I would eat like rice and curry, which is our traditional meal. I'd eat it with my hands. But it was sort of always seen as like this, like, oh, like, all right, okay, we'll let you have that because you're from this like quaint little island that no one's really heard of. And, you know, so the kind of the relationship between like, oh, you are like very exotic. And that was something that I was told a lot when I was living in San Francisco. You know, I used to get really fed up of like going to, like if I'd ever go out like to a bar or something, I'd constantly have people coming up to me and being like, where are you from? Are you from like Egypt or are you from like, you know, and they start naming these like random countries. I'm like, no, I'm from Sri Lanka. And they'd be like, oh, Sri Lanka. And like they'd like scurry back to their table and I can see like they're having like this conversation. And after a while, it's really exhausting, right? It's like, okay, that's great.
Like, yeah, like the whole guessing game is very exhausting.
Yeah, there should be, we should just put out a PSA that says exotic is not a compliment. Yeah. When you call us that, we don't feel happy about it.
Well, like there are a lot of like spooky elements to your book, like we talked about with like Mohini, but the thing that scared me the most was the gaslighting, like people not believing in what you've seen and saying like, well, you weren't in the right mind, you were drunk or like you're seeing things. And I'm like, oh God, this is just something that I'm always afraid of, and the fact that like you weaved it in with like the unreliable narrator, it was really interesting because even as a reader, I was like, I wonder if this is all real. And it was just like such like I guess like a tricky way to tie in all of the red herrings and mystery because you don't know what's real and what's not real. Was that challenging for you or did it come naturally?
I think the question is how easily we accept that a woman is losing her mind.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah,
you know, and I think as women at some point in our lives, to maybe not to the degree that Paloma faced, but I think we've all at some point being made to feel like we are crazy for feeling certain things that are, you know, that you were completely validated. But at the time, you know, someone would make you feel like, hey, is that right? Like, am I losing my mind? Am I crazy in that? And I think women face this a little more often just because, you know, there are these perception and patriarchy and plus like a whole other kind of worms, obviously. But I was very conscious of that because Paloma is abrasive, as we know, and she is to a great degree, amusing, like sarcastic jokes and things aside, she is very unlikable, right? She's got problems, obviously, with alcoholism, with just her grip on her grasp on reality. But when we come across abrasive women like that, how easy is it for us to think, oh, she's just losing her mind, right? Because we see that side and we see that difficult side, and it's easier to think that a difficult woman, right? And I say that in quotes, like a difficult woman is being, again, in quotes, crazy than it is a nice, well-presented, like, face to the world sort of person. So that was something I was very conscious of when I was writing, is how much people will tell her that she's losing her mind and how much of that she starts to believe herself after a while.
Yeah, I didn't really think about, like, oh, yeah, like, there is this deep, I guess, trauma that a lot of women have of being told constantly, like, okay, well, you're overreacting, or like what you're feeling is not valid. And it's like, oh, that makes sense because, you know, I'm terrified throughout this book and there are no ghosts or like killers around the corner. It's the real horror is, you know, sitting down and, you know, telling a police officer, I saw a body, there's something going on, there's someone stalking me, and them not believing you. It's like, were you drinking? Did you take your meds? And it's like, as someone who does take meds, this is kind of frightening.
Mm-hmm.
But you talked about like being in San Francisco, and like, I just loved how you described your settings, not just San Francisco, but like Sri Lanka as well. But like for San Francisco, it was just very amusing to me because I felt like you captured like the hipster environment. So like I was just cackling at those moments where Paloma was just like, oh, these millennial tech bros who are just, you know, they don't know anything, but you know, they want to look like they do. And
mm-hmm. So I wanted to, I did that on purpose, just because I'd spent time in San Francisco and, you know, she was angry at certain things that were happening to her when she was living in San Francisco. So it just made sense for me to do that and then set the childhood in Sri Lanka because, you know, I grew up in Sri Lanka and it just felt like it made sense for me to go about it that way. Just like full disclosure though, and I have to say, like when I was writing, you know, I think those little bits about especially people, like I would totally be someone that Paloma would make fun of, you know, like when I was writing it, I was like, oh, like, you know, green goddess smoothie, like I love me a green goddess smoothie. And like, you know, so a lot of that was just a lot of tongue in cheek, like how much fun can I make of, like even myself sometimes, or like, you know, people that I've seen. And yeah, it wasn't meant to be like cruel as much as it was just like, for me, it was just like little funny things that I could just observations, I guess.
Yeah, I like the fact that Paloma was self-aware because like you said, with the green goddess smoothie, like she does go into a store to get that. And she's like, I know I look super basic. And like, I know that, you know, like all I'm missing is a crop top and some yoga pants. And, you know, like people, mm-hmm. like, I know what this smoothie maker is thinking. And I was like, man, like the self-awareness was just so funny to me. And yeah, like, I'm pretty sure like Paloma would make fun of me as well for certain situations. So yeah, I was like cracking up.
Yeah. So your debut novel is coming out. What's next for you? Mm-hmm. Are you working on another book?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I am. I am in the editing process. So like we're just wrapping up, I think, what I hope will be sort of one of the final editing rounds of book two. Which would be out, I think, sometime next year. It is, I don't know how much I can actually speak about it, but I can say that it takes place in Sri Lanka, and it kind of centers around this big sort of Sri Lankan wedding. And again, it draws on a lot of my own experiences of growing up in sort of Colombo. It is very much more an upper class Colombo, so you definitely get to see a different side of Sri Lanka in this. Maybe not its best side. But
I mean, you just said wedding, which is another one of Rira's favorite subgenres of fiction.
I love big weddings, and if there's just, you know, if there's a body in there, yeah, I'm all for it.
Yeah, it's definitely a wedding with a body.
Okay, yeah, I'm all in. I'm very invested.
Yeah.
Oh, glad.
Awesome. Well, I think we're coming up at the end of our interview. Rira, do you have any other questions for Amanda?
Well, it's more of a comment than a question. I really hope that you continue to write books that take place in Sri Lanka because, like, I feel like I just, like, have not read enough books where it is set in Sri Lanka and is written by Sri Lankan writers, even though, judging from, like, book deals, there have been more Sri Lankan authors getting publication mm-hmm. and representation. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's very slow going. So I'm really glad that, you know, we have you on the show and we're able to introduce readers to Asian authors that aren't just from East Asia and, you know, like Southeast Asia. It's like, I'm really grateful that you took the time to speak with us. And
it was my pleasure.
Yeah. And is there anything you want your readers to take away from your book?
Ooh, that's a good question. And before I get to that, actually, just let me address really quickly. There are an amazing few, but a group of very amazing Sri Lankan writers out there. There are less Sri Lankans writing genre fiction, but now I think there are, in more recent times, a few amazing science fiction writers. And, you know, so you are seeing this emergence, which is fantastic. And I think the more, and this book deal, for example, was very, very important for me because I would like other Sri Lankan writers to know that this is a possibility, you know, seeking representation, you know, looking to get traditionally published, that is an option, because it wasn't something that had happened often enough that I knew that it was an option for me from the get-go. It was something I had to research heavily and kind of find my way through. But definitely look up. There are a lot of amazing Sri Lankan writers out there. And to get back to your question about what I hope readers would take away from this book, I think at my core with a writer, and yes, there are a lot of messages in the book. There are a lot of little frustrations that I channeled into, you know, that I hope would resonate with some people and that I hope would open many people's eyes. But at the end of the day, I just really want you to read the story and think, oh, damn, I didn't see that one coming. Like, that's what I want, right? As a writer, like, my joy, like, what the thing that makes me really happy and keep doing this is when people come back and say, like, hey, I read your book and I really enjoyed it and I didn't see that coming and I'm still thinking about it. Like, for me, that is the highest compliment that you can pay me. Really, I just want people to enjoy it because I really enjoyed writing it. So that's all I can hope for.
I just imagine, like, just mystery writers sitting back and just waiting for people to say, damn, I didn't see that coming. And going, got him. Like, do you guys keep score? Like, do you compare, like, how many got him to get?
No, and the funny thing about, like, writing in this genre is, like, people will come and say, like, the most ridiculous things to you, and you take it as a compliment, right? They'll be like, oh, my goodness, like, I couldn't sleep at night. And you're like, oh, thank you so much. You know, so much to me. They're like, oh, God, like, I was looking over my shoulder the whole time. I'm like, oh, wow, really? Thank you. It's really funny when you start to, like, take in as a compliment. It's like, you got goosebumps? Fantastic. Like, you couldn't sleep? I am thrilled.
I'm sure that's what, like, for, like, literary fiction authors, like, oh, I made you cry. Like, I made you think about, like, your family trauma. Great. Like, that is what I was going for. But I enjoyed reading your book, and I'm sure a lot of people will as well. It's perfect for Halloween. You know, the book is coming out September 14th. So keep a close eye on it, everyone.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Amanda, for joining us on Books and Boba, and have a great rest of your promotional tour. Lots of early mornings and late nights for you, I imagine.
Yes. It's been a lot of fun and a lot of coffee.
All right. Thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you so much for having me. I really love this.
And that was our interview with Amanda Giatissa, the author of My Sweet Girl, releasing in the States on September 14th. Available for pre-order now at bookstores everywhere, including our very own Books and Boba Bookshop.org, where you can help support our podcast as well as local bookstores. Rira, I guess for one last time, please remind our readers what our book club pick is for August 2021.
So we are reading Patron Saints of Nothing by Randy Verbay. We still have a little bit of time until we discuss the book on the show. So if you would like to listen to that episode, you have about a couple of days, I think.
Yeah,
it's a YA book. So it's a YA book. It's around 300 pages. So you could definitely finish it over a week. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with the premise, it's a coming-of-age story about grief, guilt, and the risks a Filipino-American teenager takes to uncover the truth about his cousin's murder during the war on drugs that was instigated by President Duterte. So it is a little bit heavy, so go in with, brace yourself. it's not a fluffy book. Brace yourselves for some angst and for some serious topics.
Yeah, and stay tuned to the Books and Boba podcast. We'll be releasing our discussion of the book in a few days. But until then, thank you once again for listening to Books and Boba. And yeah, we'll see you next time. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @BooksandBoba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Life gets a little crazy sometimes. Sometimes it's confusing, sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's beautiful, and sometimes it can just piss us off. Enter First of All Podcast. It's a safe space for real conversations about the things that we all struggle with, celebrate, contemplate, and work through in our daily lives. I'm your host, Mindy Chang. I'm an actor, filmmaker, and entrepreneur with a colorful background, a full life, and brilliant friends who I love to unpack life with to share with all of you. They are everyday people like you and me, ranging from award-winning artists, cultural icons, powerful CEOs, my hilarious childhood friends, and even my mom. Tune in for honest conversations on mental health, dating, sex, family, career, culture, and everything in between. Listen to First of All wherever you find podcasts, part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.